Good morning, this is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Water policymakers, scientists, corporate leaders, and entrepreneurs are all together this week in Milwaukee. And while that's not so unusual, given global discussions around water security and climate change, the Milwaukee-based Water Council is trying something new as it convenes its 9th annual Water Summit this morning. Instead of the typical breakout session format, the organizers are trying something called One Room, One Moderator, One Water. Experts will present on topics such as health, economics, and infrastructure, but all seen through a water lens. Then it's the job of author Charles Fishman to engage attendees in compelling conversation. Fishman is a former Metro and national reporter for The Washington Post. He wrote both the New York Times bestseller The Walmart Effect and, in 2011, The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz caught up with Fishman as he arrived for the Water Summit.
Did you take on water as a mission when you were doing a story about water bottles? Is that how this whole evolution began?
I got started thinking about water even before I did the story about bottled water. I grew up in Miami, and we visit my parents there, and we checked into a hotel in Miami about 6 years ago, and there was a bottle of Fiji water in the room. And we had driven with our kids from Philadelphia, so it was a long ride. And I would say that my wife had the bottle of Fiji water open even before the door was closed behind us. And neither one of us had ever seen Fiji water before. And the bottle had a little hang tag around the neck that said, "This bottle is here for your drinking pleasure. If you drink it, $7 will be added to your hotel room bill." It's the kind of tag my wife flicks off and doesn't even look at. And I said to my wife, "Honey, do you think that water really comes to Florida from Fiji?" And I threw the empty water bottle in my suitcase because I didn't want to forget. It seemed sort of odd, you know. And it turns out that Fiji water really does come from Fiji. The water in the bottles is from Fiji. And when I got back to the office, we were living in Philadelphia then, it turns out that 52% of the people in Fiji don't have clean, safe drinking water. So you can walk into a 7-Eleven or a Safeway or a Myers or a Walmart and buy water from Fiji anywhere in the country in the United States more easily than half the people in Fiji can get clean, safe water from Fiji. So that seemed like an important story. So I went to Fiji and learned about Fiji water. And I got to write a story about bottled water. I actually went to San Pellegrino, Italy as well. And it was a different era in journalism, we might say. And I went to Poland Spring, Maine. And I wrote a story for the business magazine that I work for on and off called Fast Company. And people were fascinated by where bottled water had come from. And that's how I stepped into the world of water. The book I ended up writing about water, the part of it that's about bottled water, is actually shorter than the original story. It's really a book about what our relationship is to water, why water availability is changing, how you tackle and solve water problems. But it's not boring. It's actually highly entertaining. Still in print, whatever, 6-7 years later.
You're here in Milwaukee, however, you're moderating Milwaukee's 9th Water Summit. So what goes into preparing for this venture here?
Well, you know, the folks hosting the Water Summit, the Water Council, Dean Amhouse, and the folks working with him, came up with a topic. The overarching topic is, how do you create resiliency in the world of water? And that's, resiliency is one of those words like creativity and innovation.
Sustainability.
It's getting a little overexposed, but it's exactly the right word. We in the United States have a great water system, but it is anything but resilient. That's why they had the problem they have in Flint, because there was only one source of water and one set of pipes and one way of getting everybody their water. That's why they had to turn the water off in Toledo 2 summers ago when there was a big algae bloom in Lake Erie. because there's only one set of water intakes. There was only one source of water for a city of more than 100,000 people. That's not resiliency. That's the opposite. That's inflexibility. That's dependence on one framework for how you do things. So the theme of this conference this year is resiliency. How do you build in flexibility to a system that traditionally is based on pipes in the ground and a pipe into a lake or a well in an aquifer? And that's a great question, because without resiliency, California wouldn't be surviving the drought. And without resiliency, we are not going to be well positioned to handle the pressure of climate change and the pressure of these sort of emerging pollutants that are getting into our water because of the consumer products and the pharmaceuticals we all take. So they picked a great theme. They picked four topics for these panels that I'm sort of kind of hosting, the way Oprah would host people on the couch. I'm just the person sparking the conversation. And then we work together to get some really smart people. We're going to be talking about water and health, water and infrastructure, what the system for delivering the water and money, which is a great topic in 2016. Most water utilities in America have more trouble finding money now than they do finding water, and that's even true in a place like Las Vegas or California. Water, we figured out. How we get the money to pay for what's necessary is a little harder. And then on Wednesday, there's a panel called Resilient Revolution, which is a pair of people who have helped transform the water systems in their cities, Washington, D.C. on one side of the country and San Antonio, Texas on the other. And we're going to hear from those two people how you actually change people's attitudes about water permanently. What does it take to change those attitudes, and what's it look like once you've done it? Lots of times you go to a conference, a water conference, a conference for whatever business you're in, pharmaceuticals, medicine, marketing, and you hear great stories, but it's all tied up with a bow once the person's up on the stage telling you how it worked. And I really, as a reporter, I really have a sense that success often requires some hard decisions and wrestling with people, and that is absolutely true in water. So I wanted to put in front of this audience some people who have done great things, but who are still in the middle of the fight, of the struggle, and can say to people, yes, we had to raise rates. Yes, we had to dig up streets. Yes, we had to replace one kind of treatment plant with another kind of treatment plant, and here is how we did it. So that the folks in the room, I hope from all of these panels, will walk off with real stories and real examples that inspire them, and that they can then take back to every corner of both the Midwest and the rest of the U.S. and fight those fights themselves.
So, Charles, you've written about the need or the lack of data and about how we price water. Those are big issues. You've talked about a couple of success stories, but nationally, we've got a ways to go. You gave an example of something I read of the difference between data on energy versus what we know about nationally about who's using the water. We just get a little snapshot, and it's not current or comprehensive.
Well, those are two really important pieces. In the United States, we track energy usage so closely that the first Thursday of every month, there's an agency of the government that reports natural gas use for the previous month, so that the month that ended 4 days previously, in every single category. How much natural gas did factories use? How much natural gas did businesses use? How much natural gas did homeowners use? Where did the natural gas come from? What was its price? And we're talking about data from literally 4 days ago for the preceding month. And by the way, you can slice and dice that down to regions and states and sections of states in the country, because you wouldn't have comprehensive data if you didn't have it literally zip code by zip code. Here's what we know about water data. We report total water data, total water use in the United States every 5 years. We only report it for years that are divisible by five. So we have it for 2015, we have it for 2010, we have it for 2005, but we don't have it for any of the years in between. But actually, that's not true. We don't have it for 2015. We got data for 2010 at the end of 2014. So we only get, for the country, water use data every 5 years for that 1 year, and it is 4 years late. Well, you know what? There's an old saying that, you know, you can't manage what you don't measure. And so we don't really have a handle on who's using what amount of water at what time in for what purpose. The 5 year snapshots are great, but they're way late. There's only literally six people worrying about water data. Energy data, there's actually an agency of 800 people who figure that out. Now, energy is vital to the way the country runs, and the price of energy goes up and down, and we really want to understand how we're using it. I would argue, and I have argued in the piece you read was in the New York Times just a couple months ago, we need the same kind of data about water as we enter this era where there's enormous pressure on the water system. Half the fruits and vegetables come from California in the United States, literally 54%. And California is going through the worst drought in 1,000 years. And yet we don't know how much water the farmers are using or where the water that's available is going or what people are paying for it. And that's just ridiculous. When the global price of oil goes up to $100 a barrel, we know what happens to energy use all across the U.S. economy. And that's really important. So that's point one. Point one is it wouldn't cost us very much. I actually did the math. It would cost each American family a dime a month. If they added a dime a month to each water bill, which some Americans might feel the pinch, but not many, couldn't afford the $1.20 that would result in, that would fund a water agency that did nothing but track data about our water use. And you know, once you understand how much you're using, it completely changes how you think about it and how you manage it. The easiest way for people to see that is that my favorite little new data point is the gauge in your car that tells you what your instantaneous gas mileage is, right? Would you rather be at 9.8 miles per gallon right now or 36 miles per gallon right now, right? So knowing what you're using immediately helps you change your behavior. And you mentioned price. We've got a panel on money, but the panel's really about how water agencies manage their finances and where they find the money to rip up pipes and replace them, to put in place new treatment technology, those kinds of things. The price of water for most Americans occasionally goes up in their water bill, but no one manages their water use in this country based on price. When I was writing the book, I said to my wife, why don't we try and reduce our water use 10 or 15% a month and see what that's like and see what's required, just so when I write the book, I have a little sense of what this is required. And I think our water bill at that point was about $30 a month, so about a dollar a day for a family of four. Very, totally typical. That's what the average bill in America is for the incoming water. And she looked at me and asked a couple, like, what would that mean? Then she gave me a quarter. She literally reached in her jeans pocket, pulled out a quarter, handed it to me and said, you know what? I'm going to keep taking the shower I want. Here's the quarter for today, and tomorrow I'll give you another quarter. Well, okay, that's a funny story, but she's making a really good point, which is that for most Americans, there's no point in trying to reduce your water use based on the cost of the water, because the water doesn't cost us very much. And you'd have to struggle, and you wouldn't even notice that it changed your water bill. And so I think out in California right now, not only do we not know how much water the Central Valley farmers are using, they pay nothing for it. It's free. They're pumping it up out of the ground free. Well, forgive me, it's not their water just because they own the land. It's water is considered a community asset. And if they had to pay even a little bit for the water, which they would pass on to us in the price of strawberries and green peppers and lettuce, they would manage that water differently. As it is, you walk into a grocery store in Milwaukee, or you walk into a grocery store in Orlando or Washington or Boston, the price of strawberries and the price of broccoli does not reflect the fact that it's the worst drought in 1,000 years in the place that produces half our fruits and vegetables. Well, there's a reason cars get 35 miles to the gallon now. There's a reason factories have shifted to natural gas. And the reason is the price of energy moves, and that creates incentives to be much smarter with that energy. No one's ever sorry that their car got 30 miles to the gallon instead of 20 miles to the gallon. And you know what? No one's ever really sorry that their toilet can flush with 1.3 gallons instead of 3. And so I think price is a tool that we don't use nearly enough to manage water, but it's hard to argue for using price when you don't even know what the water use is. So there's a lot to be done, and I think those two things are things that the group that's going to be in the rooms tomorrow at this water event, they know that really well, and they are often thinking about how to connect how much water people use, how to give them better information about that, and also how to use price as the right kind of tool.
So you've written that we're on the verge of a second water revolution. How are we doing?
Well, the first water revolution was literally 110 years ago, around 1905. The kind of people who are converging on Milwaukee for the summit, people who run water utilities and think about water policy, 100 years ago figured out that with a sand filter, by running water through a huge tank where there were 6 feet of sand at the bottom, and the water went in the top and went through the sand and came out, and then adding just a little bit of chlorine, that changed the game. That turned something that was dangerous and poisonous into something that was safe and healthy. And that cut child mortality in America in half. Half the babies who used to die stopped dying just because the water got safe. That enabled cities of 750,000 and 1 million and 3 million and 8 million people, because the water supply was there to sustain them. That was water revolution number one. Water revolution number two isn't quite so simple. It goes back to this idea of resilience, of recognizing that water is a key economic tool and a key health tool, and that you have to have an adaptable water system if you're going to have a strong, vibrant city. And you don't ever think about that because the water system generally is so great that you never think about it. The water never stops running. But all you have to do is look at what happened in Flint. If you own a house in Flint right now, $100,000 house in Flint right now, try and find somebody who's going to buy that house. Who wants to buy a house in a city where you can't drink the water? So how important is water to the basic economics of the city? Really, really, really important. And so the second revolution has to be about a much smarter water system. Everywhere you look in the American economy, from operating rooms to the offices of people who sell real estate, all those industries have been transformed by the digital revolution. Water has not. And so we need to grab hold of all the tools available, do a better job of having a variety of sources, do a better job of asking what's creeping into the water from our blood pressure medicines and our cholesterol medicines and our antidepressants and our 47 kinds of hair conditioner that we would rather not be there. How do we take that out? How do we keep the water safe, and how do we keep enough? I think two things are really important. In the big picture, a statistic most water people don't even really appreciate. In 2016, the United States of America uses less water as a country than we did in 1970. We have tripled the size of the economy between 1970 and 2016, and we've cut total water use by 10%. That's a huge achievement. Now, we've done it because the people who've done it are farmers and power companies. That's where enormous pressure has been brought to bear. So we grow more food than ever. We supply more than enough electricity for an economy three times the size of the old economy. And yet we use less water for both those things. And that's where those are big water users. Nonetheless, it's clearly possible to make huge progress. So to me, that statistic is kind of an inspiration. And the second is, here you are in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You've got incredible water resources. Not just the lake, you've got a water system that was sized to deliver twice the amount of water that the city needs now. Well, why aren't you wooing microchip companies in here? Microchip companies like AMD and Intel use huge quantities of water every day, and they build their factories in Arizona and Nevada. And they then complain that there's not enough water for them. So that's a sort of a flip example, but water is a great economic recruiting tool. And so we've begun to do really well, so the revolution is well underway. especially with big water users outside of public consciousness. And part of the water revolution is to live and work where there is great water resources, where there are great water resources available. And I think one of the reasons the Water Council here in Milwaukee exists and that they host this summit, which draws in hundreds of people, is because you guys have great water resources and great water expertise here. And so that's something to market. That's a tool.
Does your brain and does part of your message go to the individual? In other words, the fact that it's important for the individual to be water literate. You talked about water being our water, not corporate water, not the utilities water. How do you balance all that?
Sure. I wish people were water literate. And I wrote a book that I tried to make fun and engaging. But the truth is that I'm also a realist. I have a wife and two kids and two dogs, and so I know how much time there is to do my job, to take care of my family, to pay attention to the things I like to pay attention to. And so I'm not under the illusion that most people in most communities are going to spend time every week thinking about their water system. To be serious for a minute, in the framework of these larger conversations that the country's having about who to vote for president, how to cope with what happened in Orlando, a place I lived for 14 years. So I'm not under the illusion that most people have time or interest enough in water to pay attention to it for more than an hour or two a year. But even an hour or two a year would be great. Open up your water bill and see how much water you use and see how much it costs you. Look at the water bill and see what you're actually paying for, because most people on their water bill are actually paying for the clean water coming in. They're paying to treat the dirty water after it leaves their house separately. And often in a community that's near a big body of water, I live near the Potomac River and Chesapeake Bay, you all live near the lake, there's a charge for taking care of the water in the environment. Actually, we're not taking care of it. We're typically cleaning up the mess we made during the last 100 years so that those bodies of water will serve us. So look at your water bill, see how much water you use, and see if you can use 10% less next month. Just see what that would feel like, and see if you pay attention whether you can do that. Because I want people to be smart enough so that when water's on a ballot, when you're voting for somebody for city council or county commission or mayor, and they talk about water, you can understand the argument they're making and decide whether you agree or disagree with it. When you hear that taking care of stormwater, building a water reuse plant, putting in recycling systems, that those things are important and here's why they're important and here's what they're going to cost, that you have a little bit of a sense of where that fits in the scheme of things. So I'm not fantasizing. I mean, yes, I hope there's some great water geeks that we haven't tapped yet. They'll run out and buy the Big Thirst and be converted to, you know, permanent water geekdom. But what I really hope is that people will care enough to look at their water bill, which doesn't take more than 5 minutes. Water bills are not typically very well designed. It's an area that I talk to the water people about all the time. I haven't made any progress. They don't look like your iPad, unfortunately. And that don't flush the toilet once a day. Just each person in the family doesn't flush the toilet when they pee once a day. That will change your water bill. That will change your water use. That's important. That could be valuable. And then when people talk about water, pay attention to what they say, what the elected officials say, what the people who run your water utility say. Just cock an ear when they're on TV or on public radio, just so you know what the conversation's about and can have an intelligent thought about it. All you have to do is look at what happened in Flint to appreciate that the system is great, but when it doesn't work, you will wish you paid an hour's worth of attention a year so that you know what's going on.
Journalist Charles Fishman is the author of The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. He's a former reporter for The Washington Post, a reporter and editor at the Orlando Sentinel, and at the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina. Since 1996, Fishman has worked for the innovative business magazine Fast Company. Today and tomorrow, he's in Milwaukee serving as moderator of the Water Council's 9th Annual Water Summit at the Pfister Hotel. He spoke with WUWM's Susan Bentz.